is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hey, hoop heads. Wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and they truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Also, make sure to check out the new Dr. Dish home machine. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Kyle Cavanaugh from Essential Coaching, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering new subscribers 10% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code SAVE10 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its play bank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball.
Coaches, do you have a point guard or leader you're going to be counting on next season to run the show for you? Don't leave next season to chance. Thousands of coaches send their players to a point guard college camp each summer to learn to think the game, lead a team, and run the show. Your players will be smarter, better leaders, and better equipped to foster a championship culture next season in practice and in your locker room. I've seen firsthand how PGC camps have had a huge impact on players and coaches that I know, both on and off the court. You can go to pgcbasketball.com to find a 5-day, 4-night camp near you. That's pgcbasketball.com.
Every player that's on the roster knows exactly what they're going to get out of the program. Day-to-day, academically, strength and conditioning, every aspect of the program, they're familiar and they understand what's coming and they'll excel. So that's my biggest challenge, making sure that the infrastructure that we've built doesn't break.
John Griffin is the men's basketball associate head coach at St. Joseph's University, where he's responsible for coordinating the on-court player development program and overseeing the team's defense, which includes drill implementation, teaching strategies, opponent scouting, game planning, and research projects. Griffin is also tasked with recruiting, game scheduling, and serves as a liaison with the department's compliance, academics, and sports performance staffs. Griffin previously spent 4 seasons as an assistant coach at his alma mater, Bucknell, where the Bison made back-to-back appearances in the NCAA tournament. John started his collegiate coaching career on the staff at Rider, working as the director of operations until he was promoted to assistant coach, serving for 2 seasons from 2013 to 2015. Griffin was the Indiana Pacers video coordinator during the 2010-2011 season, in between a 3-year professional playing career in Europe, following an outstanding playing career at Bucknell, where he scored more than 1,000 career points. If you're looking to improve your coaching, please consider joining the Hoopheads Mentorship Program. We believe that having a mentor is the best way to maximize your potential and become a transformational coach. By matching you up with one of our experienced mentors, you'll develop a one-on-one relationship that will help your coaching, your team, your program, and your mindset. The Hoopheads Mentorship Program delivers mentoring services to basketball coaches at all levels through our team of experienced head coaches. Find out more at hoopheadspod.com or shoot me an email directly, mike@hoopheadspod.com. Follow us on social media at hoopheadspod on Twitter and Instagram, and be sure to check out the Hoopheads Podcast Network for more great basketball content. Grab your notebook right now so you don't miss any of the knowledge dropped by John Griffin, men's basketball associate head coach at St. Joseph's University.
Hello, and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Klinsing here with my co-host, Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome to the podcast the associate head coach at St. Joseph University, John Griffin. John, welcome to the Hoopheads Pod.
Guys, thank you so much for having me. Very excited to be on to share my story and really appreciate what you both do for the business. And again, just excited to be on.
Well, we appreciate those kind words, and it's always nice to know that there are people out there listening. As I've said a couple times here on the podcast, sometimes you can get the sense that you're talking to your guest and you hope that there's somebody else out there listening. So it's always good when we hear from people that have listened to some of what we've done and have found some value in it. And we're really excited to be able to have you on. And it's actually a family affair because we had your brother on this morning as part of the University at Albany group staff podcast we had going on this morning. So we're doubling down on the Griffin family today. I want to start out, John, by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell us a little bit about your first experiences with the game of basketball and just how you fell in love with it.
So I was born into the world of college basketball. My father was at one point in his career the youngest head coach in the country at Siena College. He was 25 years old. So I was born in Albany, New York, which is currently where my brother is now residing. And you know, I didn't really have a choice as to what my day-to-day life was like kind of growing up in terms of the game of basketball. Constantly conversation surrounding the game with both of my parents. And over time, as I got to understand coming up to probably around 7 to 10, I started to really understand just college basketball and the passion and excitement that was involved with the game. And my father went from Siena College in 1985, and he was there to 1988, I believe. Or 1980, he was there to 1985. I got to know my father's timeline. And then he actually got out of the business for a little bit, got into wealth management, and then returned back to the world of college basketball, resurfacing at St. Joe's, which is his alma mater. And he was a head coach there from 1990 to 95. It was at that point where I was able to really witness just college basketball in its prime. Philadelphia is widely recognized for its passion surrounding college basketball because of the Big Five. So it was during that time where I really started to just enjoy it. I would say at the age of enjoying it more than falling in love with it. My father was a multi-sport athlete, and I would say most parents influence their kids based off of their life experiences. So I was a multi-sport child growing up. And as I started to get older and being in the city of Philadelphia, the game of basketball started to get more competitive. I started to spend more time on the development side for myself. And probably sixth, seventh grade is when I really started to pick up the game of basketball. So from sixth, seventh grade, you know, on through high school and then eventually to college and eventually professionally in Europe, you know, it all started from witnessing my father's passion and energy and commitment to just being successful as a basketball coach in college basketball. And, you know, it's been a blessing. You know, for where I am now, it's been a blessing to have the perspective of being the son of a head coach, being the son of a college coach in general. So that's a brief background.
How did he bring you around the game when he was coaching? I mean, did you go to practices? Did you go on road trips? Were you around the team? How did he handle that either separation or bringing together of his home family with his basketball family?
Well, he was very intense. He's widely recognized for his intensity. And he would bring me to practice. Fortunately, St. Joe's had two gyms. One was more of a recreation gym. The other one was the home court. So usually when I would go to practice, due to his level of intensity, a manager would take me to the recreation gym. And I would just live on the rubber courts at the time during the practices. I don't think he really wanted me to get experience in his world of intensity at that stage in my life. But my best experiences being the son of a college coach were really centered around the Final Four, because the Final Four during his time, and still to a certain degree now, but during his time, was they were very authentic relationships in the world of college basketball coaches. The camaraderie, the ability to just connect with people in a very natural, organic way was what I thoroughly enjoyed, because I was in awe of all the coaches that he was friends with. So I enjoyed that aspect of it. I enjoyed going to the Final Four games itself. I have fond memories of being in Charlotte when Arkansas won and Grant Hill was unbelievable. And those were probably my best experiences with him as a son of a college coach, because I was able to just see it, by his side. And that was really how much – that was the exposure. That was where I realized how important relationships were in this business and, you know, how authentic they needed to be. They needed to carry weight. So that's how – he didn't bring me – in a long-winded way, he didn't bring me in the gym when he was in there.
He was a smart guy. He knew what you were getting into or not getting into, right?
That's right.
Who was your favorite coach that you got to meet, shake hands with, get to know as part of those trips to the Final Four? Who made an impression on you?
Well, I guess one name that sticks out to me was Jim Boeheim. And I was so young, but I was thinking John Wallace, and I remember like how massive he was on the stage of college basketball. And back in the day, the sneaker companies used to have trips for coaches. So depending on your sneaker affiliation, that was probably like the strongest relationships that you were able to create and maintain. So I felt like just shaking his hand was a prime moment for me at that early stage in my life.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think when you go back to that era of college basketball and you think about what Big Monday meant back then, I mean, those guys in the Big East, when you think about the Boeheims, the Lou Carnesecas, the John Thompsons, and just the Rolly Massiminos, the glory years of the Big East. And I mean, it's incredible just the talent level that came through there in terms of players, but also just in terms of coaching. I mean, it's just phenomenal what came through there. When you think about yourself as a player, once you started to get more serious about the game in sixth, seventh grade, how did you go about improving yourself and becoming a better player? How would you describe the balance between how much you were playing pickup basketball versus how much you were working out on your own alone in the gym?
So my father is from Philadelphia. We grew up in Philadelphia. My father went to Roman Catholic High School, which is where my brother had just been coaching for the past 5 years. And his experience in the city was one where he had to earn everything. And he had to earn his respect as a basketball player. Roman Catholic was really, really talented. And they had a lot of success during his time. But that made him into the person that he is today. And he kind of just pushed Matt and I in the same direction as we started to develop a stronger passion for the game. So we were from the, on the outskirts of Philadelphia, and around sixth grade is when we started to move our way towards the inner city world of basketball. And that world really helped build who I am today, both my character as a human, but also my character as a basketball player. So he really wanted to expose both my brother and I, in terms of letting us know where we stood when it comes to being a quote unquote good basketball player. And we got exposed quickly. We got exposed quickly. And what it did was just let us know that there was a world of basketball beyond what we thought, that you in order to be successful, you were going to have to put in unusual amount of time just on the basics, dribbling, shooting. I'm not even talking about passing, but I consider myself a good shooter as I was growing up, sixth and seventh grade, and I couldn't get my shot off in certain environments. So I had to develop a speed to which I ultimately was able to get my release and then be able to make it. So I stayed in the games. So it was about that time, sixth grade, and the AAU team that I played for that my father found and we ultimately stayed with for quite a long time was very, very talented. We had Kyle Lowry and Sean Singletary, and there were a bunch of guys that went on to play high level college basketball. And it was an incredibly competitive setting. And I only had really one way to go, or two. I was either going to stop playing basketball or figure it out. And I think what my father hoped that I did was figure it out, which I ultimately did. But it was about that time where I really had to make a decision as to, do I want to spend time working on my ball handling, which to many at that age can seem mundane, but in order to get on the court, I had to be able to dribble. And I had to be able to dribble if somebody picked me up 94 feet, which in sixth grade or seventh grade seems a little much, but depending on your environment, it wasn't. And so that's really when I started to develop a passion for it. That's really when I started to spend the most time. And that's when I started to spend most time on the fundamentals, but also, you know, creating a little bit of a niche for myself as a jump shooter and one that could get it off quickly.
So what did that look like? How do you improve that skill? What were some of the specific things that you did? I'm always curious because when I think back to, and I'm older than you, and I think back to my time of trying to improve and get better and a similar experience of trying to go and seek out better players in different neighborhoods and playing against older players and all those kinds of things that kind of help you to learn those tricks of the trade like you're describing. And yet I had to spend, obviously, just like you, a whole lot of time with my game by myself, but there wasn't the same number of resources, at least not when I was coming up, where my workouts were just something that I kind of came up with. And I pretty much did the same thing every single day. I had one workout that I would do if I was by myself, and I had another workout that I would do if I was lucky enough to have somebody to be a shooting partner with me. And that was pretty much what I did every day from the time I was 15 until the time I was 22 and I graduated from college. So how did you go about putting together your workouts and what you were working on in order to improve yourself?
Mine were very similar. It's not like it is today. I feel like there's some sort of trainer for every player in the country, it seems anyway, or some sort of training program built and put in place. Mine was very simple. What you're describing is exactly what I did. I would go in the backyard, get a basketball, and a lot of my, let's just say, dribbling drills, for example, were as game-like as possible. I tried to simulate in my own mind while going through dribbling drills, what it would be like in a game. So could I go up and down the driveway, change speeds? I wasn't kind of born a ball handler, so to say. So it didn't come natural to me. I had to develop the hand speed dexterity element of dribbling a basketball just to be competent as a dribbler. And that took time. So I had to keep it simple first. Going through your legs, behind your back, it really didn't apply to me because I couldn't do it in a competitive setting.
Understood.
So I had to find a way to build that into a dribbling routine, but also work on changing speeds, keeping the ball in the same hand so I can get it up the court and get it out of my hands and ultimately, hopefully, get it back. So that was like majority of my workouts, honestly, from probably sixth grade to when I finished playing professionally. Of course, as I got older, I tried to incorporate somebody that would rebound for me so that I didn't have to run all over the gym.
Right.
But I valued, one, the cardio aspect. I valued the game simulation aspect. And I valued changing speeds because I needed it. So from a ball handling perspective, I did a lot of full court, running. And of course, I did some of the stationary stuff to make sure that my hand speed was where it needed to be. And then from a jump shooting perspective, I had to just figure out how to make shots on the move. Because it was very rare that I was going to get opportunities starting in sixth grade as a wide open catch and shoot jump shooter. And that was a lot of footwork. You know, we grew up where we had, I don't know if you guys know what this is, you probably do, a pop shot.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so we had a pop shot in my basement, which we have now for my kids, which I'm pretty sure they're putting holes in the walls, throwing the ball against the backboard as hard as possible. But I truly believe the pop shot impacted the speed of my release, because we would have competitions in the basement. And in order to win these competitions, the ball had to hit your fingers and get out of your hand at a ridiculous rate, so that you could get the number that was required to win between my father, my brother, and I. And I eventually was able to build a release that was very quick. So then I had to figure out, and I was fairly tall, younger in my life, and I wish that I continued on the trajectory that a pediatrician said I was supposed to be going to.
Those pediatricians, yeah. they mess up that all the time.
All the time. I'm going to make sure that they don't tell me how tall my oldest
yeah,
would be.
Don't listen to that.
If they do, I mean, I'm going to be the parent. I'm going to be the AAU parent that say, you need to play my son. He's going to be 6'5".
Exactly.
So I had to then figure out a way to be able to make shots and in a very competitive environment. And that took time, and that took a lot of misses before makes. Fortunately, I'm confident by nature, so I just kept plugging away. And then the final piece to my development at a younger age, and it didn't actually help me until I was a junior in high school, because I didn't really have to be that much of a playmaker even in high school. Like in AAU, I had Sean Singletary and Kyle Lauer. Sean Singletary, hands down, best AAU player I've ever been around. And I don't know if you remember Sean Singletary. He went to Virginia. He was, you know, playing the NBA, cup of coffee in the NBA, but is very well known in the Virginia basketball community for this, like, step back against Duke. I'm pretty sure it was overtime. I see it regularly. Sean was a stud, but he was the primary ball handler. And then you got Kyle Lowry, who, what you see now in Kyle in terms of like a junkyard dog of a guard is what he was as a sixth grader.
Yeah, that's not surprising. Yeah.
No, I mean, he was an absolute, like, animal as a player. He was fearless, and he was, like, the smallest guy on our team. And then by the time he was a senior in high school, he's looking down at me. But I had to develop some element of, like, point guard skills. My father was an undersized forward in high school at Roman Catholic. He had a chip on his shoulder. He's well known within the city during his time as just being a physical undersized forward. He had to develop a ball handling ability so that when he played in college, he could play his natural position. So he valued, because I was taller, he would never, didn't matter what team I was on outside of the AU team where we didn't have a choice. He never let me play any other position except for point guard. So I was able to build some comfort in handling the ball with people in my space, people near my feet, and make plays and be a confident, aggressive player. So on my local school team, I played the point guard, and I was very fortunate that even my coach in seventh and eighth grade, although I was the tallest player on the team, allowed me to be the point guard, allowed me to bring the ball up the floor. Because you don't see that very often in this day and age. If you're the tallest guy, they're going to put you closer to the basket.
Yep, that's for sure. Yep.
And it hurts your development if you're at a certain talent level anyway. So that's kind of how I was able to just build develop my skill level to the point where I was able to play varsity and ultimately play college basketball.
What's your favorite memory from high school basketball, if you can pick out just one?
I've had a number. So I played for a guy named Speedy Morris, William Speedy Morris, who should be in the Hall of Fame. He's been nominated a number of times. William Speedy Morris is a legend in the coaching industry, but he's without a doubt a legend in Philadelphia. And we had unbelievable success when we were together. We won two Philadelphia Catholic League championships, and both of them were against the same team, Cardinal Doherty, which was Kyle Lowry's high school team. So I would put those two and combine them as two of the best experiences for me in high school.
All right. So obviously you have an outstanding high school career. Talk a little bit about your recruitment and ultimately your decision to go to Bucknell, how that came to be, what were some of the other places you considered, and what ultimately led to you choosing Bucknell as the place that would be best for you to continue your career.
Yeah, well, I didn't have a great recruitment process, actually. And the reason being was because are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. We can hear
okay.
you.
Okay. The reason being was because in high school, I didn't handle the ball as a point guard. We had one of my best friends in life who was an unbelievable player. Actually went on and played for Coach Chaney at Temple. His name was Chris Clark. He was our point guard, and nobody stole the ball from him. So Coach Morris was not going to take him off the ball.
He was good with that. He was okay with him.
Yeah. You were not taking the ball no matter what from Chris Clark. So I was never able to fully showcase, even in AAU, I was never fully able to showcase my ability to handle the basketball. So my recruitment process stayed at a certain level until the summer of my junior year, where I actually take you behind the curtain here. My father used his network and we developed a plan. And so for anybody listening, you know, if you want to be recruited, this might be an interesting plan that you follow. Okay. So I wasn't very quick. I wasn't dunking or very vertically athletic by any means. So I had we developed a plan that could showcase my abilities to make decisions, be a point guard, show that I could shoot, and prove that I was a Division I player. So going into my senior year, the summer before, which is now Hoop Group. It was there's the Hoop Group Invitational. I forget what it's called now, what it was called. The plan was, because you put in all these different teams, the plan was you have to be the point guard. Okay, I'm confident by nature, so establishing like that alpha role was not hard for me. And people that are friends with me can attest that I'm probably overly confident at times. So, all right, check that box. Have to be the point guard. That's one. Two, if you get the ball swung to you and the defender is not closing out to you, pass it. Because I was not quick enough to create any advantage unless the defensive player was closing out. So I didn't want to show any college coaches that I was slow. So I just passed it.
There you go.
So they didn't mark that as a negative. Three, if I was in transition and it's a 2-on-1 break, I'm pulling up for three. Like try to get as many of those pull up threes off as possible. Now we worked on this. We worked on it for about 2 weeks leading up to this camp. Four was set a ton of back screens. The more back screens you set, the more opportunities you will have to shoot, which I did. And five was pick up full court. And although I was laterally limited, the fact that I was outwardly confident and I picked up full court was viewed as a positive because I looked like a competitor as opposed to looking just like an absolute liability on the defensive
end.
Just
a guy standing on the defensive end of the floor waiting for somebody to blow by him. Right. There you go.
So I executed that plan. I made a lot of shots. Thankfully, the ball went in the basket that week and I left with 10 scholarship offers. And one of them had been Bucknell. So long story after that, short is I visited a few schools, Ivy League and Patriot League. And it came down to Rider University. Coach Don Harnum was a great friend and mentor to me now. And Bucknell. And I obviously have a huge passion for Philadelphia basketball. And I was at the time a little disappointed that I didn't get recruited by anybody in the city. But when comparing the two, the academics of Bucknell had a little bit of an advantage, and that was very valuable to my family and I. And Bucknell's got amazing facilities. At the time, it was a brand new facility that had just been built, and that was also played a major factor in my decision, because my parents are thinking academics. As I say to most kids now, that when you're recruiting them, the kid's not really thinking academics. They may say that, but they're thinking basketball right. only.
So, absolutely, yeah.
So it looked like an opportunity for me because of the facility to have a successful basketball experience.
Yeah, I mean, I think when it comes down to it, you hit the nail on the head when you say that ultimately it comes down to basketball. I mean, I had one Division I scholarship opportunity, and I took it, and it wouldn't have mattered. It ended up being Kent State, but it could have been whoever, and I would have taken it because I believed I was a Division I player and that I just needed an opportunity, and wherever that opportunity was going to happen, that's where I was going to go, because I wanted to be able to give it a shot. And, you know, I ended up by happenstance probably in the right place for me, and got an opportunity to play and have a good career and all those kinds of things. And it's interesting when you talk about a player. It sounds like you and I were very similar in terms of our ability to get up and down off the floor, and our ability to move laterally, and our ability to shoot the ball and handle the ball. Like, I played point guard all summer. I was probably more of a two guard when I got to college, but I played some backup point, and I played half a season as the point guard when I was a senior, when our senior point guard got injured. That was part of my class. But all summer long, I wanted the ball in my hands, because it's how you get better. You don't get better handling the ball by standing off on the wing and just shooting threes. Yeah, you got to move sure. and you got to be able to do things. You got to have the ball in your hands. And I just always loved that part of the game. I love to pass and just love to be the guy that kind of made things go. And so whenever I got an opportunity to do that in the summer, I certainly took advantage of it. And, you know, it sounds like your plan was, you know, along the same lines, that if you wanted to get better, you had to do some things that were going to allow you to show some skills that maybe you couldn't during your regular season because of circumstance and guys that were playing that position around you. And you get to Bucknell, obviously you have a great career there. Tell us a little bit about, just give me a highlight again of playing at Bucknell, and then we can get into when coaching gets on your radar.
Yeah. I mean, I, again, similar to my high school experience, I walked into an unbelievable environment from a basketball perspective. There was a group of guys in the locker room on the team that, one, had a ridiculous passion for the game, and two, were very talented. We were huge. We were one of the biggest teams that the Patriot League to this day has ever seen. So my first year, we have a tough little beginning of the season, and then we beat Pitt at Pitt. They were seventh in the country. Went on that year to beat Kansas. We were 14 seed, and we lost to Wisconsin the next game. I mean, at that moment, I'm thinking to myself, does it get much better than this? Where we beat basically the top tier program in college basketball, and then the following year, we had everyone coming back. We had everyone coming back, and we had an unbelievable center. We had really good guards, and we actually, for a Patriot League team, we were 23rd in the country. We were a 9 seed in the NCAA tournament, and we beat Arkansas in the first round and lost to John Calipari's Memphis team in the second round. They were a 1 seed. So, again, and similar to my high school, is there one moment? No, there's two. There's two wins in the NCAA tournament, without a doubt, are as memorable as anything that I was able to accomplish during my college career.
Yeah, that's exciting to be able to get to the tournament. My freshman year, we lost in the finals of the MAC tournament by 1 point to Ball State, and then that my freshman year, I maybe played 6 or 7 minutes a game, and you know, you get that close, and you know, part of you says, we lost. We'll have another opportunity to get back. And my sophomore year, we were really good again, and I think we won 21 games and got upset in the first round of the tournament. And then my last 2 years as a junior and senior, we just never really put it together, and you know, never got close again. And so that's one of the things that you look back on. You're like, man, you know, we were so close to be able to experience and get into the NCAA tournament, which of course all of us grow up watching and, you know, wanting to be a part of and dreaming about. And now you look back on it and you say, oh, we were just, you know, one point away. So for you to be able to have that experience twice, and not only that, but to win a game each time you went in there, I'm sure is just, again, that's a memory that's seared into your mind. That's never going to go away. As you're wrapping up your playing career in college, are you starting to think about coaching? Are you still looking at the opportunity to play over in Europe? What's your mindset as you're finishing up your 4 years at Bucknell?
I never even really knew much about European basketball. I had known, you know, certain elements of it from my father's coaching in the 90s, as to some of his players went on and did well, but it never really entered my world until we had success and I saw my teammates start to do it. And one of my teammates, who is currently an NBA assistant with the Milwaukee Bucks, had great success his first year playing professionally. So similar to you, my junior year, we lost in the championship. They didn't have the rule in place where if you won the league, you go to the NIT. So our season ended. And then my senior year, we had a bunch of injuries and we're really young. But statistically, I did well enough to get an opportunity. So I was hungry to keep playing. You know, I think that my passion for playing, even to this day, is strong. So I wanted to maximize my time, and I had gotten my grandmother's Italian. So they worked for about 12 months, my mom and my grandmother, in getting Italian citizenship. So ultimately we were able to become dual citizens. Not that it had any impact in the end, but it was because of my teammates that went before me that it opened the idea of doing it. And during my high school career, 2004 was my senior year. Jameer Nelson, Delonte West, that was the kind of miracle run of St. Joe's. They were unbelievable. But I was very fortunate. They kept the door open for me even after my father resigned and retired. And I was able to build a really strong relationship with those guys, majority of the guys. And I was in the gym with them all the time. So even seeing how their careers just exploded really just kept me wanting more.
It
said, okay, I want to keep playing for as long as possible. So that's where it went. And I ended up I played 1 year in Germany, tore my ACL, had to come back. Instead of kind of getting into coaching then, I received great advice from Dave Paulson, who was the head coach of Bucknell at the time, because I spoke to him about getting into coaching. And he said to me, if you still love to play, don't get into coaching, because you'll mentally struggle with the fact that you're not playing. And I took that advice very seriously. And I, to this day, if anybody that's a former player wants to get into coaching, I echo that advice. It was great advice. So instead of getting into coaching right then, I rehabbed and went to Slovakia and did the whole thing again. And I don't regret it. So I'm grateful that Coach Paulson gave me that advice.
Tell us about the experience playing overseas in terms of the adjustment to the cultures, in terms of the adjustment living on your own. What was the language barrier like, the food, just what was the experience like for you overall?
Looking back, it was an unbelievable experience. In the moment, I was a little homesick. You know, I think most young adults complain about absolutely everything. So I'm sure I just burned people's ear with complaints of what was wrong, blah, blah, blah. But looking back, it was an incredible experience. And my first year was in Germany. Germany has a huge army base, it has an American culture in Germany. So everyone spoke English. It was an easy world to really dive into. And I enjoyed my time there. We were very good. The team that I was on, we won the league. We moved up a level. And I ended up having individual success that probably would have propelled me forward until I tore my ACL. My most fond memory in Germany was non-basketball related at Oktoberfest in Munich. It was quite an experience, just visually speaking, just seeing the sheer number of people drinking beer. And I was in awe because they don't have anything that replicates it in the States. And then That's from there, funny. Once I rehabbed, I went back to Bratislava, Slovakia. I went back way too early. I was too heavy. I already had my jumping limitations, and I didn't make a shot. So after seven games, I said, thank you for coming over here. Here's the rest of your money, and adios. So I went.
The real question, John, was, were you too heavy because you celebrated too much at Oktoberfest? That's the real question.
Well, there's definitely an element of that for sure. I mean, Oktoberfest, if anybody is still single and doesn't have the number of kids that I have and they have time, I recommend making that trip for sure. And they were nice. You know, the coaching staff in Bratislava was nice in my departure. But I left there. I came home. And that's, you know, to lead into the next segue here, that's when I kind of get into coaching because I had to reevaluate the next step.
All right, two Euro basketball stories. First, or questions. First one is, what was your favorite site, city, place that you got an opportunity to see while you were over there? And then give us your best PG-13 and below story from European basketball.
So the best city, it's a little challenging, but Vienna. Vienna is without a doubt my favorite city. That I was able to kind of enjoy, and from a best PG-13 story, because of my experiences, Germany was the most stable environment, but they have in the town that I played, they were most well known for having this enormous Christmas game. So as a European basketball player, you can kind of reinvent yourself. So, and that means like wear long hair, wear it in a ponytail, all the things that you ever wanted to do, you can do.
Because nobody knows you are,
they probably won't see you.
Give it a shot.
Yeah. 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 Why not? You know, you see people do it on TV. This is your opportunity. You're a pro and you have that professional ego. So yeah, I played a game with, you know, my hair in a bun. So, and then we won, and it was a great celebration in the end. So that was probably one of my best memories. And then finally, like the one amazing part about European professional basketball that 10 out of 10 European professional basketball players will tell you is that they know how to celebrate championships better than anybody. They know how to celebrate wins better than anybody. the raw energy that the fans, just because of soccer and the passion and how everyone grew up just following that sport and like how one goal really mattered, they know how to celebrate a championship better than anybody. So when we won the championship, it was a lot of fun. There was a lot of there was just a big party, and that was a really significant moment for me.
There were some Oktoberfest activities.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, the Oktoberfest experience, just the sheer size of the beer mugs. I was thinking to myself, this is out. Like, and the waitresses can carry like six at a time.
Yeah, that's tremendous. That is good stuff. I mean, again, I think those experiences, like you said, in the moment, I'm sure it was challenging, and I've heard that from other people. And yet you look back on that, the opportunity to do that when you're a young person, to be exposed to those different cultures and different people and to get those world experiences, which obviously, as the three of us all know, as you get older, being able to have those experiences gets more challenging when you have other people that are depending on you and that if you want to go experience those things, bringing them along is much more of a challenge than it is when you're just a single guy hopping around Europe and playing some basketball and with lots of free time on your hands. So it's a different world once you get to the age where all of us are. All right, let's transition from playing to coaching. Tell me a little bit about the mental switch that you had to flip in order to transition from playing to coaching, and then let's just kind of go through your itinerary one stop at a time and talk about what you learned along the way.
Yeah. So I think it's important to note, because I've had this conversation with a number of friends of mine that have played professional basketball in Europe or know people that are playing professional basketball in Europe. There is an identity shift to not being a player anymore, that it's can be a tough realization. So for me, although I've been around the game of basketball my entire life, my father was in coaching and then was out of coaching and then was back in and then was out. So we've had a different outlook on it, especially as we grew older. He was at our games and he was around us as opposed to coaching other teams. And the idea of coaching never really crossed our minds, both my brother and I, and maybe he will say it differently, but at least in my mind, it never really crossed my mind because playing was the only thing I wanted to do.
That's exactly what Matt said. He said the exact same thing.
Yeah. So essentially for me, as soon as I returned home from my Slovakian experience, my father kind of just put it on me. As most parents do, they say, okay, here's reality. And what direction do you want to go? So the natural direction for me was basketball. And I really didn't give anything else a chance. And looking back, would I have given something else a chance? I might have. If I know what I know now, if I knew what I know now. And so an opportunity from a relationship that my father's relationships, it showed its face, and it was a very intriguing situation. I had gone through a couple interviews for graduate assistant positions, and Jim O'Brien was the head coach of the Indiana Pacers, and he had a video coordinator intern position available with the Pacers, and he basically said, "Why don't you come out here for the summer league? See if it makes sense to you. And if it does, you know, let's do it." So I went out there and I was very intrigued. I really wanted to learn the world of NBA basketball because it was always a goal of mine to be a player at that level, like it is for everybody. But since I wasn't going to have that opportunity, I felt this would be a great chance for me to learn what goes on behind the scenes. So I went out there, enjoyed it, and ended up committing to the position and started my coaching journey that year. And let me tell you, if I were to just, from an academic standpoint, that year with them was like getting my master's on steroids, without a doubt. Now, it was very humbling because I went from this ego of I'm a European professional basketball player to the lowest person on the totem pole. And it really changed my entire work rate, my work ethic, and helped me develop as a human. And if I didn't have that experience, there's no chance I would be the person that I am today in the coaching world. So I was very fortunate, but that's how I started this journey, getting into it at the lowest level in professional basketball.
Did you know anything about the video room or how to do any of that stuff before you took the job?
I knew nothing. And I've seen Eric Spoelstra refer to it as like the dungeon. And it was. There's no windows. And in 2010, the technology has evolved in 11 years. But in 2010, it was, you still had the live code, but the room was full of DVD machines and TV screens and old school computer screens, like it was no laptops or anything like that, you know? And so I had to learn on the fly. And that was, like I said, it was very humbling. It couldn't have been a better situation for me as somebody that at the time thought they knew everything and was confident that I'm sure my confidence was not appreciated at times by the head video coordinator and the assistant video coordinator, but they did a great job in just helping me transition into this new life kind of world. And yeah, I learned it on the fly. I'm pretty proficient now, but it was challenging. It took probably about a month to be trusted.
I can only imagine what that means when you're pulling up something and, hey, where's this supposed to be? I thought John was in charge of that. Where's that clip going to be? Where'd that game disappear to?
Yeah. I mean, that's the video stuff. I tell people that ask, oh, can you go to the NBA? Can you go to the college? What's this position like compared to this position? And in the NBA, everything is done at the highest level. You know, everyone that is working in the NBA as an assistant or a head coach essentially should have a doctor next to their name as it's associated to the game of basketball. So you're going to be challenged regularly. And like I said, for me, it was a blessing because I wanted that. But I also wanted to see what the relationships were like behind the scenes. And I wanted to see what the strength coach was like. And I wanted to see what the gear and the food and everything that came with being part of an NBA program was about. And it's completely been a major piece to who I am now as a coach.
Hey, hoopheads, we all hate ankle sprains and they happen way too often. Ankle injuries are the number one sports-related injury. Arise is trying to change that. With the iFast, your athletes get preventative protection and full mobility. Athletes no longer need to wear bulky braces that limit performance and give mediocre protection. Anyone playing sports should be using these products. Keep your athletes in the game. Don't wait for them to get hurt to take action. Visit www.arise.com/teampricing to learn more. That's ARYSE.com. What was surprising to you about what you learned in that year about how the NBA did things? Was there something that jumps out at you? You're like, man, I can't believe that they do this, or I can't believe they do it that way, or I can't believe this is what goes on. Was there something that jumped out at you?
Well, a few things, actually. It wasn't just one thing, but a few things. One, just the normal casual environment of an NBA locker room. I think there's an element of like unknown where you look at all these players on TV and social media, but they're just regular people. So that was an easy thing for me because outgoing, I just wanted to connect with people. I think that the amount of video work that's done, and now data at the time, analytics at the time was still very, very early in its, you know, NBA kind of world like it is now. So just seeing how the coaches prepared for opponents, as well as tried to find ways to make sure that their team progressed, was very interesting to me because it takes a ton of work, because knowledge is key at that level. Knowledge is key. These guys are without a doubt the best basketball players in the world. And similar to any industry that has the best in the world, you have to be on it. You have to be locked in every single day so that when you're challenged, you know exactly what direction you want to go as a coach, as you know, as a communicator. So I learned the importance of being yourself, being knowledgeable, creating relationships, and then working. Every morning, because I was the lowest man on the totem pole, and there was a Dunkin' Donuts two blocks down the street, and everyone in the NBA, at least in our organization, seemingly drank coffee. And I don't know if it was just them challenging me, but everyone seemed to drink coffee. I was going at 7 a.m., two blocks, grabbing eight coffees. And I didn't drink coffee. Now I do. Like, it's like there's sunflower seeds. But I'd bring eight coffees back. Thankfully, about 3 months into my time with the Pacers, they put a Dunkin' Donuts in the building.
Nice.
All that stuff really just taught me how to work and the importance of it all. So it wasn't really one thing, but it was, you know, knowledge, communicate, and be yourself.
Was there a particular player or coach that you bonded with that year? Somebody that you really were able to build a relationship with over the course of that year that you became close to?
Yeah, I became close to everybody on the staff. So Frank Vogel was an assistant, and that particular year, Coach O'Brien actually departed mid-year, and Coach Vogel became the head coach, the interim, mid-year, and we finished in eighth place. But Walter McCarty was on the staff. Walt is an unbelievable personality, very well known for his playing days at Kentucky and very well known for his charisma as a person in the NBA. So I got really close with Walt. There's a guy now who's an assistant for the 76ers who I believe is probably the best defensive mind I've ever been around. His name's Dan Burke. He was a great mentor for me, and he still is. And then there were a few other assistants. Those two in particular really took me under their wing and made it – they seemingly not really made it a mission, but gave me time, which now I appreciate even more because I know there's so many different things pulling you different ways. So I really appreciate they gave me time.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think when you talk about being able to bring somebody along, especially somebody who, in your case, comes in and you don't know anything about what it is that you're supposed to be doing. And there's obviously a learning curve there, and it's going to take some time. And if you had gotten with, you know, the wrong group of guys or a group of guys that was more selfish with their time, then that experience probably could have gone a completely different way and maybe turned you off in a way that could have prompted you to go a different direction with your career. Did that experience with the Pacers, how did it impact your decision in terms of the level that you wanted to coach at? Did that make you think, man, I really want to stay with the NBA? Did that make you have more just wonder, hey, well, now I've experienced the NBA game. I want to go and see what college basketball is all about. What was your mindset after going through that experience for the first season?
Well, the NBA, unfortunately, at the end of that year went into a lockout. So I didn't really have much of a choice because a lot of the support staff were left behind. So I had to either go back and play or continue my coaching career. And I actually went back and played. I went to England and played because during my time with the Pacers, the idea of a player development coach wasn't as standard as it is now. So Coach O'Brien, and I'm incredibly grateful for the autonomy that he gave me at such a young age. He allowed me to work out the players like Lance Stephenson and Paul George, the younger guys, and then the older guys at the time were like TJ Ford and James Posey, like incredible humans. And like James Posey and like TJ Ford and I would play one-on-one all the time. And he never made me feel like I was superior to him. But it kind of rejuvenated the playing juices. So
relit. The fire got relit, huh?
It probably didn't take much, right?
Wouldn't have taken much for that to happen.
Like, my younger brother actually mentioned something in his best man speech at my wedding regarding the reigniting of that passion for playing, which was pretty funny. But I think the other aspect, I was probably young and dumb, where I most likely could have said, I don't need to play. Now, I'm glad I did it, but if I had been a little bit more persistent with staying around Coach Vogel and the Indiana Pacers, I might have had an opportunity to come back. And the NBA experience, you know, I wasn't really looking at it. Sometimes I hear this, if you go to the NBA, you can't go back to college. If you go to college, you can't go back to the NBA. I'm not a great believer in that, although there are two completely different worlds. I kind of just, looking back, I probably just should have stuck it out and been persistent, but I didn't. And then I lucked out in my next spot at Rider with Coach Baggett. And, you know, it is what it is.
How does that opportunity come to you?
St. Joe's connection. So Kevin Baggett is a St. Joe's alum, and my brother actually spent the first 2 years of his career at Rider. So he had a great relationship with Kevin Baggett, and Tom Dempsey had taken the job at Binghamton, and Kevin Baggett had just been named the head coach at Rider. And we connected while he was figuring out his staff, and the director of basketball operations position at Rider at the time was volunteer. And I wasn't afraid of that. You know, like I said, the Pacers experience had prepared me from a work rate perspective. So the idea of working for free didn't scare me, and I jumped all in to being the director of basketball operations.
What did you learn from that experience that was different maybe from what you learned with the Pacers? Was there something that stood out to you from a standpoint of how college was different from the pros, how your role as a director of ops was different from your role as a video coordinator? Just kind of give us the difference between those first two experiences.
Well, director of operations at Rider, and probably similar at all those level college programs, you're limited in terms of your resources. Obviously, in the NBA, resources are plentiful, so you can just provide for the players as they need. I think the director of operations position, the one thing that I was prepared for was putting on multiple hats. And I think that's an advantage as you go into this world of college basketball coaching. If you've been a director of operations, you know that there are so many boxes to check. So what I learned during my director of basketball operations time with Coach Baggett was, because I was basically Bags's, I was like attached at the hip as he's experiencing this head coaching situation for the first time. There's a lot of things that you have to make sure that you're ahead of and that you are preparing for as it pertains to just the day-to-day for the program. So academics, travel, gear, food, practice time, non-conference scheduling, and then all the video stuff. Thankfully, I was prepared for the video stuff. We didn't have a video coordinator or anything like that. So I was way ahead of the game. I think Bags definitely appreciated that I was way ahead of the game when it came to video preparation for opponents, et cetera.
That made you a valuable guy on the staff for sure.
There's no doubt. There's no doubt. There's many things that make you invaluable, and being proficient at the video stuff is one of them.
All right. Next thing I want to ask you is, when you think about just that time as an assistant coach and you start looking at how you want your career to sort of unfold, do you have a plan for writing down notes, journaling, keeping things that you want to sort of stash away that you may use in your next position, at your next stop, in the eventuality that you might take over a program at some point in the future? When do you start to kind of collect a portfolio of coaching material, for lack of a better way of saying it? And how do you organize that if you do?
Well, it's funny. At one point in time, journaling is constant. I think journaling, collecting information for most coaches is constant. I think staying organized in that world is very beneficial if you're able to do so. You know, depending on the number of jobs and in the institutions, if you can store it away when your computer gets taken, that's also very beneficial.
There you go.
But I made a goal for myself. The first dinner I had with Coach O'Brien with the Pacers, and he said, "What do you want to be in 5 years, or where do you want to be?" And I'm sure I gave him some ridiculous answer where he literally probably didn't stop chewing, where he probably thought to himself, "Yeah, this guy's got no clue how unpredictable this business is." And from that point, 5 years later, I had married. I was living in Lewisburg. I had two children. So I couldn't have been further away from what I told him at the dinner table. And really, for me, it's now where I just try to, and I know this is cliche because I've basically heard this on every podcast I've ever listened to, but I just really try to live in the moment. I really try to live in the moment. I think this business can be really distracting. I think social media enhances the distractions of career movement, career opportunities. But at the same time, for me, the mentality of being a head coach is something that's always at the forefront of my mind. Every decision that I'm asked to make, I try to make it as if I'm the head coach of the program in which I'm working in, so that I can keep just prepare myself to be a decision maker when it's crunch time. And that's just the mentality that I've taken due to my father's influence. Because he was a head coach at such a young age, and then even as my brother kind of undertook his journey as a head coach, decisions, there's so many to make. So how do you gain that experience without being in that seat, which is a question that's constantly asked when you're going through an interview process. And, you know, the answer that I give is just every decision that's being made is made from a head coach's perspective without being in that seat. So I just try to, I really just try to challenge myself in having impact on the program that I'm with and live day to day when it comes to the world of college basketball.
That's a good piece of advice, I'm sure, that anybody out there should take. And whether you're a coach or you're not a coach, living day to day and just being focused on where you are is always a good piece of advice. When you think about these early stages of your career, what is something that you feel like as a coach came naturally to you that you were pretty good at right out of the gate? And then what's something that you feel like was an area that was maybe a weakness or that you weren't very good at, but that you've been able to develop over the course of your career?
Well, the last 2 years, so my Indiana Pacers year, I consider the year that I received my master's degree in coaching. And then these past 2 years at St. Joe's, I feel as though Billy Lang, Coach Lang's really helped develop and fine tune my world of coaching. And I've received my PhD. And I think early in my career and still to this point, what comes naturally to me just based off my life experiences is building relationships and diving deep into the players that are in the locker room and the people that are on the staff and making sure that the relationships feel and are organic outside of the game, because basketball is so competitive and there's an element of confidence that, you know, can really waver while being a player. So my role is to make sure that the players feel confident and comfortable. And I also feel like the development piece on the floor in terms of building confidence and creating a daily routine so that the players that are in the program feel as though they're progressing. Those two elements come natural to me. Now, the one where I've been, where I've really been challenged is just organization. Because at a certain level of college basketball, your organization level has to be elite or you'll end up getting distracted too quickly. And you won't spend your time efficiently, and it can be very overwhelming because there's just a sense of urgency that's required to be successful. And there's times where, let's just say at Bucknell in the Patriot League, where you don't have to maybe, you're not challenged on that daily basis because the students are doing so well academically. And so this has really been one of those eye-opening 2 years where, and I've gotten better at this, but the first year was a challenge from an organization standpoint.
So when you talk organization, give me a concrete example of what you mean in terms of you having to be more organized in a particular area. Let's just say it is academics. How do you go about keeping that organized, keeping on top of it? What does that look like for you as a coach, putting that together to make sure you're on top of what you need to be?
Well, for me, it's putting things to paper or to a Word document in an organized, efficient manner where the words, the sentences, the phrases, everything makes sense. And it's not too long. It's not too short. Whether, I don't know, I think the idea of a to-do list can be overwhelming, but pertaining to academics, it's have you met with the player? If the player needs help, what do they need help in? Have you followed up with the academic side of campus? Is a plan in place? You know, those are four major things right there that have to be accomplished that you can't push off to the side. So they're going to take your attention. And if you end up dropping that into a bucket and not really circling back to it with the attention that's needed because you're distracted by, okay, let's just say Twitter, for lack of a better other thing, you know, then that element that you are required to figure out doesn't get done. Not in the way that it needs to get done. So that would be an example where you have to really make sure that everything that needs to be accomplished gets accomplished in a timely manner at a high level. And that Twitter can't solve for you.
No, Twitter will not solve that problem for sure. It will do a great job of distracting you, but it is not going to help you be organized. I can vouch for that.
Right.
All right.
So that's
go ahead.
No, you're good.
Go ahead.
I got nothing else on that front.
All right. So after Ryder, you get a chance to go back to your alma mater and coach at Bucknell. What's that experience like going from, you know, your previous experience with the program as a player? Now you come back in as a member of the staff. How special was that opportunity for you to return, quote, back home?
It was a great moment for my family. My wife was pregnant, and we were living in New Jersey, and it was an opportunity for us to step away from the chaos of the New Jersey, New York world. And for me, my experience and the relationships that I had built during my time as a player, the opportunity to come back and really spend time with those people in a different setting was really special. And the head coach, Nathan Davis, was an assistant and helped recruit me during my high school time. So I had known him since I was 18 years old. And actually, each stop of the way for my coaching career, I've come in when the head coach is just taking over the position. So it was a great learning opportunity as well. Coach Davis has had a ton of success. His win-loss record, his win percentage is through the roof. So I was just really excited to be reconnected with somebody that I was so close with in terms of relationship at a place that we both love. And we both had great experience, shared experiences. And we were ready to go. We were ready to take the Patriot League on by storm. Coach Paulson did us a great favor and left us some pretty unbelievable players. And
and that always helps, right?
Without a doubt. It sure does. So it was just a really exciting time. It was the right time. It was really hard to leave Bags because Bags gave me that opportunity when I really needed it. But it was the right time, and it was the right program for my family and I.
Let's talk about your family. Once you meet your wife, you get married. First of all, does she know what she's getting into before she marries you?
She does. So my wife was an assistant on the women's side for 7 years.
Okay. And
I've actually seen I've seen a lot of women's college basketball. I'm constantly reminded by my father-in-law that my wife scored more points than me in high school. She scored more points than me in college. She's a better coach than me. She should be a head coach already. So she is very familiar with the world of college basketball, the turnover, the at times instability. But we have a great partner. She's very I'm so lucky because I can come home. And if I wanted to talk about basketball, I could. Now, we normally don't, but I could if I needed to. So I'm very lucky. She's very much in tune with the world of and the business of college basketball or basketball in general.
As you think about your kids growing up as the sons of a coach, and obviously you had a similar experience with your dad growing up as the son of a coach, how do you envision in an ideal world, how do you envision that coming together at some point in the future? Let's say whether you continue to be an assistant, whether you eventually get to take over your own program, how do you envision incorporating them into your day-to-day? What do you do with it now to keep them around what you do? And then what do you anticipate them doing around the game as they get older?
Well, my 5-year-old is in tune. He is locked into any program that we are a part of. You know, he's 5, will be 6 in August. He knows every player on our team right now at St. Joe's. He is fully aware of what happens during the games. And it's really fun for my wife and I to see how he kind of remembers different plays and talks about the wins And unfortunately, the number of losses that we've had, I really am just going to include them. And I've been so lucky. The players on our team here at St. Joe's, the players at Bucknell, they are incredibly open, caring kids. So bringing my boys around has been easy because the players that we've been fortunate to be around are all for just spending time with them. And I grew up where my father's players were my idols, without a doubt. They were my idols. Like I wore the number 11 at Bucknell because of a player that played for my dad, Rashid Bey. He was an absolute stud of a player, and he was tough as nails. And I wore 11 because he was inspiring to me. So I know the significance of the player to coach's son relationship, and I just want them to experience. And my oldest, my five-year-old, he loves basketball. He doesn't consider practicing his jump shot playing basketball. Only competition.
That's only kind. Gotcha. Yeah, gotcha.
If I'm not playing one-on-one, we're not playing basketball. I could really? Be laying, just exhausted, laying on the floor under the hoop as he shoots it. That's not playing. My three-year-old, he doesn't know if we're winning or losing.
Yeah, you got a lot of time. You got a lot of time. I got time. Trust me.
Yeah,
you got
I just want to bring them around and make it as fun for them, similar to my experience as possible.
Yeah, for sure. Let's talk a little bit about recruiting, because obviously bringing in the right kind of players, not only from a talent standpoint to help your team win, but also when you start talking about guys that you want to spend time with as a coach and that you want to be around your family and that kind of thing. Obviously, it's been a little challenging with COVID and you're doing a lot more watching guys on tape and that kind of thing. But when you start looking at a player, and obviously there's a certain skill set, a certain level of talent that they have to have in order to even be considered to be able to play at St. Joseph's. But what do you guys look for? What are some of the intangible things that when you're looking at a kid, when you're talking to them or talking to their family or talking to their high school or AAU coach, what are some of those intangible things that you look for?
We ask a lot of questions. So we are looking to build out more or less a player bio, both on and off the court, to make sure that they fit like the program and the standards of the program. So we have a fairly specific style of play. So from a basketball on-court standpoint, we try to recruit to the style. We are perimeter spacing oriented. We play with what I know it's a buzz term, NBA pace, but we have data to back our style. So we try to recruit players that we feel can fit and excel in what we are trying to do. Now, we have a tendency to take a lot of threes, so there has to be an element of shooting to the player. And so once we've identified the particular skill set that fits our needs, we then dive deep into who they are as people. And that just takes like groundwork, getting on the phone, figuring out even from people that might not be associated directly with the player, you know, what people think of that particular guy. And right now it is challenging in some aspects. I think for my perspective, the most challenging piece is evaluation, because everything is video, and video is really hard to determine actual height and actual speed and actual athleticism. I think you can for sure tell the level of talent. But the other elements that are also important, it's just can be a little bit of a guessing game in terms of those other pieces based on watching film. So once we've identified the talent that fits, though, we build out that bio and we just recruit well as a staff. I think that's one of our advantages, that as a unit, we're in it together. There's no egos. There's nobody trying to outduel one another. So we've done a fairly decent job in that department. And I think it's important because the other part of it is these kids can't visit campus. So they have to be comfortable with who you are, who your staff is. And then from there, you just work.
How do you balance the evaluation of a kid when you're watching them with their high school team versus when you watch them in an AAU environment? Are you looking for the same things? Are you looking for different things in different environments? Just how do you balance out your evaluation between those two sort of distinct environments that a kid might be playing in that you could see them?
Yeah, that's a challenge. It's a great question. I don't know if I have an answer for it. I think there's an element of a guessing involved. I think you kind of weigh both based off what you're seeing visually, based off of the rosters. AAU might have more of a competitive opponent based on the opponent's roster and maybe where those players are committing for college, and high school maybe less competitive, but it can be a challenge. And I'm openly admitting that there is at times maybe a little deception in the sense that you may under-evaluate somebody because of that balance or over-evaluate somebody because of what you perceive the right percentages in that balance. So I don't really have an answer for you. I think it's just it's a hard thing to figure out. And what it takes is a lot of film study so that you're not, you're limiting this guessing game. You're really trying to figure out, does both match? You know, and that'd be my answer to that. It's a tough one.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, I always think that, you know, when you talk about watching a kid on video and you mentioned, you know, you can't tell the real size and you can't tell the speed because you're only looking at them relative to those other 10 kids that are on the floor. Whereas if you're there in person, you know, your eyeballs in person can tell that, you know, a little bit easier. I would think that over time, especially as you get to and you've been at a program for a while, you can start to get a little bit better at evaluating off of film. What are the kind of guys that, you know, you're looking for? What are the things that pop out that fit what your program is going to do? But I still got to believe that to do it all over video as compared to being able to do it in person is a big adjustment and makes it a challenge without question. If you had advice for a kid who believes that they're a Division I player or their parent, a kid who's maybe, quote, under-recruited, what's the best way for a high school athlete or their parents and their parents to reach out to make contact with college coaches so that they don't seem overbearing and crazy, but they're just trying to get the word out about their kid's playing ability? Now, this being said, John, I'm talking about somebody who's realistic about what that player is. In other words, if it's a kid who has no chance of playing college basketball and they're sending you video, obviously it doesn't matter what they do, they're not going to have an opportunity. But let's say it truly is a kid who has the ability to play at the college level. What's the best way for them to reach out to a college program in your mind to be able to get their attention?
Well, it's an interesting question. I've actually thought about this quite a bit because I feel for those families. It's not an easy topic. There's no easy answer, no easy way to do it. Most people resort to sending an email, and college coaches these days tend to get 30 to 40 emails a day regarding a player that's supposedly going to help win 5 to 7 games the following year. And that can be hard to really dive into as a coach in terms of your daily time. I would say the first part of it is if there is some sort of connection to the coach, be a friend, family member, acquaintance that could directly contact a coach from the institution, similar to networking for a job in any industry, go with the network first so that there's word of mouth. I'm a big believer in word of mouth. And then if you're going to resort to an email, keep it short. I think the other challenge is highlight tapes. They don't show everything. I could create a highlight tape of my year practicing right now, and you would think that I was pretty good. And I think that if it's the highlight film is too long, then the coach won't watch it. If it's too short, he might just push it off to the side. So finding that balance of 2 minutes where it's not just 30 straight made threes and there's some element of what they feel like can impact your team would be beneficial. But the email can't be, let's say, 2 paragraph. It's got to be fairly brief. And if you want to throw in that other schools are recruiting you to inflate at least the idea of what type of player you are, that would help. But I would say still, number one thing would use your network if you have it.
How do you evaluate basketball IQ? I know you can look at skill on the floor and you can see, wait, hey, this kid can shoot it, or look, this kid's got a good handle. But I think one of the things that, from an intangible standpoint, obviously that impacts winning is you can have a kid who's tremendously skilled but has no idea how to play. And I think that today's basketball world, with the amount of time the kids spend one-on-one with a trainer where they're just working individually on their game, and then you get into an AAU environment where in a lot of times it's just, hey, your turn, my turn. And now you get into a college program where you're expected to play within a system and make your teammates better. To me, as an outsider, I would think that the most difficult thing to be able to identify and be able to project is what's this kid's basketball IQ when he's playing with other players of a similar skill level and talent level to what he has. So how do you evaluate a player's basketball IQ?
Yeah, I mean, you kind of just basically talked about the difficulties for sure. And you have to look at the totality of the situation and the environment. I think AU is a little bit more of a transition driven environment. There's a lot more space. You know, people aren't walking it up the floor. So, you know, can they make quick decisions? What type of decisions are they making in the flow of the game? I think if you sit back and you dissect the speed of the decisions that the player is making, it could be offense or defense. It could be a defensive rotation, but if it's within the speed of the game, you know, you can assume that they have a general idea of where they are supposed to be based on what the coach said. And if those add up, well, then, yeah, I'd say that that would be a good indication that there is a level of IQ that player has. The other piece to it is the coach, the staff, and what the reputation for the program, you know, amongst the basketball world in terms of style of play, what it is and what they're well known for. If it's a high school program, an AAU program that plays in a lot of pick and rolls and they're successful, well then if it's a guard, you can assume that they pretty regularly practice pick and rolls decisions. So, okay, that's an advantage. If they run a lot of sets and you see somebody running the flex offense, well, you might have to dig a little deeper and see if they understand the concepts of offense, or they're just running the play because they know they have to be in a certain spot. So you really got to just dig deep. You have to watch. You have to watch both sides of the ball, offense and defense, to see if these players are making quick decisions that ultimately will translate from an IQ standpoint to college basketball. I think that can be, it's actually a little bit easier to watch on film, believe it or not, because you can pause or rewind.
Right. Yeah.
And see if the player was there.
Look at what the options were that the kid had before he made the decision.
Right. In person, you can get enamored by the overall athleticism of a certain player, and that might distract you from identifying whether that player's basketball instincts can translate to your level.
Once you get a kid on campus and you get them in your program, how do you continue to develop them from, again, from an IQ standpoint, from a decision-making standpoint, where you can trust them to put them out on the floor that they're going to make good decisions? What are some things that you do in practice or in your player development program to help them to develop that basketball IQ?
Well, because of Coach Lang's background in the NBA, he was with the 76ers for 6 years, and they used film as a teaching tool every single day. So consistency is a big piece to that development. And it's there's got to be a plan in place, and you have to execute the plan. So if you need interior player to be a better pick and roll defensive decision maker, you got to show him film, and it's got to be daily so that he starts to visualize the actions and the movement patterns that's required. So for us, it's consistency, and it's a plan, and it's recognizing a weakness, and whether that be finishing a layup off 2 feet. Now, how do we get somebody to do that in a game? Well, okay, a lot of elements. Get a heavy ball, get pads, do it every single day. It can be monotonous until you see the results. So we've done a good job of developing plans for players so they can progress. But film is a big piece to that, and creativity and consistency. And just following through without getting too outrageous with the plan.
How much time do you spend with the kids watching film? So let's say it's an individual player development thing in the off season. Are you showing them their own clips? Are you showing them clips of guys in the NBA who are working on a particular move or skill that you'd like to see them develop? Are you showing things from previous seasons of like, look, here's a guard that we had 2 years ago that really executes this particular read off the pick and roll really well. Here's 5 clips of him doing that successfully. Take a look at these and see if you can incorporate that into your game. How do you use the film with the players in terms of development? Let's not talk about the scouting report and that kind of thing, but just more about individual player development.
Yeah, we do both. We do both. We have enough film now from practice and game situations to without a doubt show the player themselves in the action that we're looking to help them get better. And we also use NBA footage, and we use it because it's exciting and it's captivating. So why would we ignore it? Everyone watches the NBA, especially this time of year where there's no college basketball on TV. So we find players that or styles of play. And again, this is an advantage for us because Billy Lang, having just been in the NBA for 6 years, he scouted almost every opponent at least once. So stylistically speaking, he knows which teams are comparable to us. So we can just watch a full game, grab whatever we need to grab, and show the player. And I think there's an element of general excitement out of a player when they're watching an NBA player do something similar to what we hope they're able to do. Because, you know, right now it can get monotonous, especially during a COVID year. Yeah. Which I hope to never have again.
Let's hope we're done with that.
Yeah, but you're trying to create this element of enjoyment around the game right now after a full season. And so you have to be creative, and you have to live in the player's world. So I think we're pretty good at that, but we do a combination of both, but we definitely use the NBA stuff to our advantage.
Yeah, and I'm sure players for sure appreciate that because, like you said, if they're seeing something like, hey, an NBA player can execute that, and the coaches believe that I can execute that same maneuver, whatever it may be, whether it's footwork or a particular read or a particular type of pass or an action that you're trying to get off the pick and roll, I'm sure the players take that to heart and they really dial in and focus in. John, I feel like we have like 3 more hours to talk about stuff.
Yeah,
I mean, I really do, but we've gone an hour and a half. So I want to wrap up by asking you one final question. And it's a question that I've been using a lot on the podcast recently, because I think it sort of encapsulates everything that we've talked about. And that is, when you look ahead over the next year or two, what's the biggest challenge that you have in front of you? And then number two, what's your biggest joy? When you get out of bed in the morning and you roll into the office there at St. Joseph's, what are you thankful for? What's the biggest joy that you get from your current position and what you do every day?
So I would say for the biggest challenge part really is it's continuing to build what we're building. I think you taking over any job right now in its climate due to the transfer portal and just due to the overall environment of college basketball, there's going to be a roster restructuring and you have to build the infrastructure. So for us, it's continuing. And for me, it's all the infrastructure that's been built in the first two years. Make sure that it doesn't break.
Right.
And really make sure it doesn't break going into year three so that every player that's on the roster knows exactly what they're going to get out of the program day to day, academically, strength and conditioning, every aspect of the program. They're familiar and they understand what's coming and they'll excel. So that's my biggest challenge, making sure that the infrastructure that we've built doesn't break. And most enjoyable piece for me is without a doubt seeing the players. Without a doubt. It's the energy, the smiles, the vibes. There's hands down. That's the most enjoyable part of my entrance into the office. So I'm a highly energetic guy. I think any player that's ever played for me will tell you that I'm like borderline crazy in terms of, of energy. I'm completely okay with that. It's just, you know, in my world of overly confident, I've now pushed it into overly energetic. So I enjoy seeing the guys and I enjoy seeing the fact that they're happy to be around.
Overly energetic is a good quality to have. There's no question about that.
Yeah.
And then when you come home, you can sleep in front of your kid's Nerf hoop while they're raining jumpers on your head while you're falling asleep.
I think our players think it's because of the coffee habit that I've developed from my video coordinator days.
There you go. You got one in your hand all the time?
Yeah, it's like it's become a vice.
That's funny.
I could drink one now and fall asleep in 10 minutes. It's not good.
Yeah, there are probably worse vices than that though. You could do a lot worse.
Sure.
You could do a lot worse than coffee when it comes to vices. All right, before we get out, John, I want to give you a chance. Share where people can connect with you, social media, website, email, whatever you want to share. And then after you do that, I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
I'm not a major poster on social media. I sadly don't have much of a presence or a brand on Twitter. My email is jgriffin@sju.edu. Very much available to any young coaches specifically that are looking to break into the business or just have questions. I'm not like the cliche responder. I'm not, like I said earlier, I'm not a believer that if you're in the NBA, you can't be in college and vice versa. I kind of look at it and just evaluate each situation in its own and give you whatever advice I feel you may need at the time. So feel free to email me, reach out without a doubt. And then my Twitter, I don't even know what it is.
We'll find it. Jason's got it. Jason, jump in. Give it to us. I know you already tweeted it out at some point.
John Griffin 3 or something like that. Hold on.
Yeah,
let me pull it up.
It's at John Griffin, and then I'm the third.
You're the third. I was wondering if you were I was really confused when I looked at it because I didn't hear that.
So it's John Griffin and 3 I's. John Griffin 3 I's. Like
there
the
it is.
I.
Yeah. All right. Well, now people will be able to find you on there. Although it sounds like you may not catch that. I would recommend email based on this conversation.
Yeah, yeah, I'd recommend email. My wife is a social media machine in this family. So
there you go. Well, John, I cannot thank you enough for jumping out with us tonight. Jason and I both appreciate your time. We appreciate Bobby Jordan from Wagner, who has been a huge supporter of the podcast that hooked us up. And it's just been, again, like I said, it felt like we talked for an hour and a half, and I felt like we still had 3 more hours worth of conversation that we could have continued. So we're going to have you back on again at some point. But we appreciate your time.
Thank you, guys. You guys do a great job, like I said, and I'm very appreciative that you gave me the chance to tell my story.
Yeah, absolutely. And we don't take it lightly when somebody takes the time to spend with our audience and with us. And so thank you. And to everyone out there, we appreciate you listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast presented by Head Start Basketball.